Between vacations, errands, and everyday summer chaos, sticking to your health goals can be tough. Luckily, Thrive Market does the hard work for you. We're the online healthy grocery store that cuts out the junk ingredients and delivers high-quality groceries right to your door. From low-sugar beach snacks to organic grill night staples, no matter your health goal, we make shopping healthy a breeze. Go to thrivemarket.com/get started for 30% off your first order and a free $60 gift.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
From the office to a first date, there's a lot of pressure to wear the right clothes for every situation. But clothes don't make the man. With Mack Weldon, you can build a wardrobe that looks polished in any setting and tells the world that you stay you wherever you go. They combine timeless style with modern performance materials to keep you looking good and feeling comfortable all day, no matter what's on today's agenda. Browse everything from shorts and polos to sweats and crews. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 25% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MACKWELDON.com, promo code MACK25.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
You know that moment in a courtroom when everything just kind of seems to click, like the gears of the lock falling into place one after another until you hear that final, the door swings open? That was today in the trial of Karen Reed. In a trial that's had more twists than a corkscrew, today might have been the day things actually started to align. And not in a speculative what-if kind of way. We're talking data. Cold, unblinking, time-stamped data. Straight from Karen Reed's Lexus and John O'Keefe's phone. Two digital witnesses who don't forget, don't embellish, and don't take sides. Let me know what you think about the testimony today in the comment section if you're watching us on YouTube or Twitter, X, wherever it may be. Love to hear your thoughts. Be sure to press subscribe if you're listening on the podcast platforms, wherever it is, and do check out YouTube and vice versa. Press subscribe wherever you're at so you don't miss any of our coverage on this case and the many cases that we're covering for you right here at True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. Okay, on with this story. The star of the day was a guy named Shannon Burgess, okay? Now, Burgess isn't a household name, but he's a digital forensic expert, the kind of guy who speaks fluent data and can pull breadcrumbs out of the tech most people never even realize is tracking them. And while we'll get to some colorful questions about his resume later, what mattered today was what he found, because what he uncovered may be the single most damning piece of evidence we've seen thus far. Burgess took the stand and held it out, laid it all out for everyone. Reed's Lexus SUV, the one she was driving that night, was shifted out of reverse between 12:32:04 and 12:32:12 a.m. in the morning on January 29th, 2022. Okay, so let that sink in. 8 seconds. Here's a kicker. John O'Keefe's iPhone? It was locked for the final time at 2:32:09 a.m. right in the middle of that window. His phone never moved again. For prosecutors, that overlap wasn't just a coincidence, it was the collision. According to them, this is the exact moment John O'Keefe was struck, allegedly by Karen Reed's SUV as she backed out of the driveway at 34 Fairview Road. The implication? That this wasn't just an unfortunate accident, but the moment of impact that ended his life. No guesswork, no circumstantial theory, just timestamps, data. The car said it, the phone said it, and later, well, so did Karen. Yes, because in another spectacular moment of this trial, Karen's mouth gets her again in interviews that she gave after the fact. It's really quite stunning, but We'll get to that in a moment. The data Burgess used came from a micro SD card buried inside the Lexus's event data recorder. Think of it like a car's version of a black box. This isn't new tech, but it is often overlooked. In fact, it was overlooked in this very case until Burgess got involved. Previous analysts never retrieved it, whether they didn't know where to look or didn't dig deep enough. The point is they missed it. Burgess didn't. That detail wasn't lost on the jury. Here was a new piece of evidence presented with the kind of surgical precision that prosecutors love, showing Reed's vehicle movement and O'Keefe's phone activity aligning with a 3-second window. That's not the kind of detail you can fake. These aren't witness statements. These are time-coded records burned into digital memory. You can't coach a Lexus to lie. Of course, the defense objected to this new analysis being introduced. They argued it was late. They argued it shifted the timeline. They argued it wasn't fair. But Judge Cannone let it in. And once it was in, it became the spine of the prosecution's narrative. This wasn't just about proving Karen Reed was near the scene. This was about when, down to the second. And that's where the audio comes in. In addition to the black box data, the jury heard 3 audio clips from Karen Reed herself. Interview recordings made not under duress, not under cross-examination, but during the early phase of the investigation when she was speaking freely. In one clip, Reed explains how she overshot the turn into Fairview Road that night. She says she had to pull a 3-point turn a little closer, a little after at 12:20 a.m. to get back on track. The prosecution used this to place her close to the scene, not long before the impact window. It's not a confession, but it definitely is proximity. Then came the 12:41 a.m. voicemail. Reed had called O'Keefe, and on this message, you can allegedly hear her SUV pulling into his driveway or garage. Now, here's where the prosecution leaned hard. If this voicemail really captured the sound of her arrival, then she was at the scene well after O'Keefe was already lying in the snow. That, they argue, makes this voicemail less about concern and more about trying to restage the scene. But maybe the most telling clip was the third one. In it, Reed plainly states that O'Keefe was believed to have died around 12:25 or 12:30 a.m. That statement by itself might seem harmless, but matched against the Lexus data and the iPhone timestamp, it's incredibly specific. In fact, it's almost too accurate, uncomfortably close to the actual window when the Lexus was in reverse and O'Keefe's phone went silent. Prosecutors didn't need to say much after that. They just let the alignment speak for itself. You've got the car shifting out of reverse at 12:32:04. You've got the phone locking at 12:32:09. You've got Reed herself estimating the time of death occurred around 12:25 or 12:30. And you got all of this tied up with a clean bow in the form of expert forensic testimony and machine-logged timestamps. Even for a jury that's been through nearly 3 weeks of dueling experts, alternate theories, and timeline disputes, this moment felt a little different. It felt sharp. It felt surgical. Hard to dismiss. Not theoretical. Not anecdotal. Just hardwired events all converging at the same time in the same place. Because keep in mind, Karen saying, "We think he died around 2:25 or 2:30 in the morning." Okay? Well, that puts you there. And if it puts you, you know, just leaving or something, that doesn't give any time for this "they beat him up outside" story. And if, why would you know he died at that time? Why? The wonder that is Karen Reed. Just like, how do you know where he was in the snow? Why do you think he got hit by a plow if he got in the house? Little contradictions there. She had no comment outside of court later in the day when asked about it. A little flustered, too. When asked what she thought of Burgess's testimony, she said, "Incredible. I mean, uncredible," is how she said it. A little flustered. Sure, you can argue about interpretations, you can debate intent, but what you can't do is make this kind of digital alignment go away. It is the kind of evidence that doesn't care about reputations, resumes, or reasonable doubt. It just is. And for a prosecution that spent much of the trial trying to keep jurors anchored in evidence and out of the drama, this was a major win. And what made it even more effective was that none of it relied on character. None of it relied on emotion. It was numbers, seconds, coordinates. It's the sort of evidence that doesn't blink under cross-examination because it can't. It also can't give you the finger either. There's more to talk about here, especially the defense's attempt to discredit Burgess himself, which, let's just say, didn't go quite the way they hoped. And that's a whole story in itself, and it deserves the next piece of our time to break that part of the case down. Because when a defense tries to tear down the expert instead of the evidence, and when that effort boomerangs, it's not just a misstep. It's a problem, especially when the data still stands, which is what we're about to get into right now. Shannon Burgess had just finished presenting some of the most technically precise, potentially case-defining forensic analysis we've seen so far. He tied Karen Reed's Lexus to the exact second John O'Keefe's iPhone stopped responding, suggesting a collision in that moment that was impossible to ignore. But when it was time for cross-examination, defense attorney Alan Jackson didn't go after the timestamps. He didn't challenge the micro SD data. He didn't even try to argue with the forensic methods used. Nope, he went after Burgess's college degree, or more specifically, the fact that he didn't actually have one. It was a move that screamed distraction. Jackson pulled out old versions of Burgess's resume that listed a bachelor's degree in computer science from the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Problem was, Burgess doesn't have that degree. And when pressed, he admitted it under oath. No ducking, no dancing, just said flat out, "I do not have a bachelor's degree." You could feel that oxygen shift in the courtroom. This was the moment the defense had been saving like a grenade in their back pocket. And to be fair, it's not a great look. Burgess's resume, as it appeared in older court records, including one from a 2023 Texas case, listed that degree. Jackson used it like a crowbar, prying into credibility. If this guy was willing to fudge his education, the defense argued, why should anyone trust the rest of what he's saying? They threw around words like mendacity, painted him as dishonest, and implied that all his data was suspect because the man himself couldn't be trusted. And here's the thing about grenades. They're messy, and this one, it kind of blew back. Because when the prosecution, in this case, got their turn on a redirect, Assistant DA Hank Brennan didn't waste time. He reminded the court that whatever was or wasn't in an old resume, none of that document was used in this courtroom. The Commonwealth didn't bring Burgess in because of some line on his CV. They brought him in because of his work speaking for itself. Brennan pointed out that Burgess had already updated his resume by October of 24 to reflect that he was currently pursuing a degree. He emphasized that Burgess has testified in dozens of trials across multiple states, and never once has his lack of a degree invalidated his expertise. Because unlike in academia, forensic analysis isn't judged on diplomas. It's judged on results. And Burgess has results. He found evidence in this case that previous analysis missed entirely. He pulled data from a vehicle's internal system that no one else had accessed, using tools and techniques that aren't available to your average investigator. His timeline was built from raw machine data, not interpretation, and that data hasn't been contradicted, not by another expert, not by the defense, not by anyone. So while the defense kept trying to get the jury to look at the resume, the prosecution just pointed them back to the car, back to the black box, back to the hard numbers. And if you listen closely, it was pretty clear what Brennan was doing. He didn't just defend Burgess. He reminded everyone that the courtroom isn't a college admissions office. It's a place where facts matter more than formatting. The digital fingerprint Burgess uncovered still exists, whether or not he wrote a thesis in undergrad. Then just as the courtroom settled from that skirmish, the Commonwealth called their next witness, Christina Hanley, a forensic scientist from the Massachusetts State Police Crime Lab. Her appearance wasn't as dramatic, but it was important. She walked the jury through the evidence that she processed from the scene, broken plastic pieces, fragments of red taillight, glass shards, and even a clear drinking glass collected from the vicinity of 34 Fairview Road and from Karen Reed's SUV. This wasn't speculative. It was her testimony. Hanley explained how each item was received, cataloged, and preserved under proper chain of custody protocols. She described how these materials were visually analyzed and categorized for potential evidentiary release. Some of those fragments, prosecutors contend, connect the crime scene to Reed's vehicle, physically reinforcing the timeline that Burgess had already digitally established. The defense tried to poke those holes too, but their attempts fell flat. At one point, they seized on what Hanley called a misstatement about the date of death. She mentioned January 29th, when the official date is actually January 30th. It was a throwaway line, the kind of verbal slip that happens in any long-form testimony. But the defense pounced on it, suggesting it was further evidence of carelessness or worse, systematic sloppiness or conspiracy. Problem was, it didn't sink. Didn't stick either. Hanley clarified the error immediately, and the prosecution moved forward without a pause. The jury, by that point, had already spent the day watching the defense try to sell doubt while the prosecution kept stacking verifiable evidence. It was around this time that Judge Beverly Cannone called for a sidebar with both legal teams. We don't know what was said. Those conversations are sealed, but it likely concerned the evidentiary logistics or scheduling, whatever it was. It ended with the judge adjourning court for the day. But by then, the message had already landed. The defense may have hoped for the collapse or hoped to collapse the Commonwealth's case by assassinating the character of one expert witness, but they underestimated two things. First, how well Burgess knew his material. And second, how little a resume matters when your data lines up perfectly with the timeline of a man's death. They didn't manage to break the case. If anything, they reminded the jury that when your best counter-argument is a typo from Texas, maybe the real story isn't in the man, but in the evidence he brought with him. Tell me in the comments what you think about today's testimony in the trial of Karen Reed on X, Twitter, wherever you're watching this, YouTube. And if you're listening to us on the podcast platforms, please press subscribe and also check out our YouTube channel or socials so you can join in the conversation. I hate that term. It sounds so cliche, but you know, it is what it is. So we'd love to have you over there to do just that. My name is Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
If true crime is your obsession, we've got you covered. Press subscribe now to the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today for nonstop coverage, expert insights, and in-depth analysis.